We're going to continue setting the scene for the conference championship games. We just went through the SEC and the ACC. Now we go to the Pac-12, where we learned never to assume. I picked UCLA. I thought that was a fair pick.
I did too.
In their game against Arizona State. But Arizona State comes roaring out of the tunnel and finds a way to beat UCLA. It was actually a very tightly contested game after the first half. Arizona State won that one 38-33. They won the second quarter 21-3, taking a 35-13 lead into halftime. UCLA obviously found a way back into the game, but UCLA's offensive line threw it away for the Bruins. Brett Hundley was sacked, what, nine times in that game? Just not good enough. So this is why you don't assume in college football, because I honestly thought there was going to be a discussion to have here between Oregon and the winner of the USC-UCLA game. Well, with Oregon's blowout to Arizona last weekend, actually in that game, if I'm not mistaken, Kadeem Carey of Arizona ran for more yards than Oregon as an entire team did. Believe I saw that. Going to confirm that real quick. He did. Kadeem Carey, 48 carries for 206 yards and 4 touchdowns. Oregon only ran for 198 yards on 35 carries and no touchdowns. Arizona beating Oregon 42-16 means Stanford all of a sudden has their shot in the ACC North, not in the ACC North, in the Pac-12 North back, and they get to face an Arizona State team in the Pac-12 championship game, which is actually a set a week earlier than we thought it would be.
Yeah, and you talked about Kadeem Carey. I'll talk about B.J. Denker. He came out of nowhere, the quarterback for Arizona in that upset versus Oregon, and just played absolutely phenomenally, outplayed a Heisman frontrunner, and we'll kind of talk about these Heisman frontrunners later on in the show, but he made Marcus Mariota look inefficient as Denker was 19 for 22. But in terms of the Pac-12 struggle for that title, you have the South and the North set, as Brett just mentioned, Stanford versus Arizona State, and you also talked about sacks in this game that Arizona State played versus UCLA. It was ironic for me that on one of the last plays of the game, after getting sacked 8 times, Brett Hundley, trying to lead a comeback, gets sacked again. The other theme of the game in the first half, especially for UCLA, was penalties.
Yeah.
And they got a holding penalty on that same drive. So it was 3rd and 35 that Brett Hundley needed to convert in order to give his chance a team to win the game with under a minute left. And All-American linebacker Anthony Barr gave him the ball twice in the last 5 minutes by making spectacular plays. He hurried up Taylor Kelly and rushed him into making a poor throw, which gave Hundley the ball once, and then they had to punt, UCLA did, and of course, once again, Anthony Barr comes out of nowhere to make a play, gives the ball back to Hundley, and as I just mentioned, a sack and a penalty ended that game to a 38-35 tune. I don't know. I think Todd Graham's squad's very talented, and obviously he's appearing in the Pac-12 championship game in just his second year, but I think Stanford, as I've said all year, is the B version of Alabama, and I think right now the B version of Alabama will be good enough to prevail in this Pac-12 contest.
We'll have to see that one in a couple of weeks. Now we're finally going to wrap this up with the Big 12, where Oklahoma State took a grip over the conference with their win over Baylor yesterday. They beat Baylor convincingly in that big matchup on Saturday, last Saturday, I should say. Oklahoma State won that one 49-17. Technically, there's a three-way tie for first place in the Big 12 between Oklahoma State, Baylor, and Texas. Oklahoma State being 7-1 in conference. They obviously lead it right now, but even if they were just 6-1 like Baylor and Texas currently are, they have the tiebreaker over both of them because Oklahoma State beat both Baylor and Texas earlier in the year. The Cowboys beat the Longhorns by a score of 38-13. Now, all Oklahoma State has to do to win the Big 12 is beat Oklahoma at home. Now, Blake Bell probably has something to say about that. I'm sure he wouldn't mind turning around Oklahoma season on a dime and getting that 10th win in the Bedlam game against Oklahoma State. But if that does not end up being the case, then Oklahoma State would be out of it. Then it would come down to either Baylor beating TCU and Texas, or Texas beating Baylor, and then Texas Tech, yes. So Oklahoma State has really the inside track to the Big 12 championship game, not or the Big 12 title, I should say, since they don't have a championship game anymore, not only because they only have one game left, but they also have a bye week before the Bedlam game against Oklahoma.
Yeah, Big 12 likes to mislead you. They advertise 12 teams, and they only have 10, so no fault there. No fault there, Red. But I don't know. I don't buy Texas being able to beat both Texas Tech and Baylor. That's a very tough thing to do. And how about Oklahoma State? They really, the only team I can think to compare them to is the team they just won. They look like a much won against. They look like a much more well-oiled version of Baylor. Obviously, Baylor missing their top two running backs and their number two wide receiver. But at the same time, Baylor should still win out. Texas Christian has been pedestrian, and Texas doesn't have the secondary or tackling necessary to stop the Baylor receivers, who before this game were very well known for their yards after catch, and I think that that's going to pick up. I think that the lack of yards after catch in this instance on November 23rd was more due to the talent of Oklahoma State's secondary, and especially a guy who I really liked for some postseason awards, hadn't been named any watch list, Justin Gilbert. He's got six interceptions and two pick sixes and plays a very good shutdown corner there for Mike Gundy's crew. But for the most part, as I just mentioned, Glenn Spencer is the one to be attributed for that, the defensive coordinator for Oklahoma State. So I think that Oklahoma State, as the front runner here in this race, certainly should be able to close this one out. Texas obviously is on the slide after making a comeback after their initial struggles to start that season off, but Baylor's going to need to get healthy if they're going to want to continue to make strides down the way, and Oklahoma State should beat Oklahoma.
I think OK State has the ability to beat Oklahoma. We saw what they did with Baylor's offense last week. Really a fantastic showing from OK State's defensive coordinator. Their defense as a whole, you're starting to look out to the Midwest and the West, and you think basically Arizona State has the best defensive line out there along with Stanford. But then Oklahoma State comes in and shows up against Baylor. Maybe they're not an entirely offensive program either, although they're obviously known for their offense. Their defense obviously had something to prove, and they did just that in the win over Baylor. Now let's get our focus back on Alabama-Auburn and go to our Crimson Classics. Every week we go into the history books and get into some of the greater matchups between these two football teams, the bitter rivals, Auburn and Alabama. And we're going to start back in 1964, where Alabama won 21-14 over the hated Auburn Tigers. This was actually the last time Auburn would hold a series lead in this series. This win for Alabama tied it at 14-14-1. Alabama went on to win in 65, 66, 67, and 68. And since then, Alabama has held the series lead. It currently stands at 42-34-1. But back in 1964, where Alabama won this one, 21-14, Alabama struck first with 6 points in the first quarter, then again with 8 points in the third. Auburn only scored 14, two touchdowns, one in the second, one in the fourth. Alabama actually not a very good day rushing, only had 124 yards on the ground compared to Auburn's 187, but turnovers for Auburn, and then what Alabama was able to do with those turnovers. Actually, the first score of the game came from a fumble recovery for a touchdown. Who'd have thought that an Auburn-Alabama game would come down to defense? Of course, came down to defense on this day.
Especially with Joe Namath as your quarterback for Alabama. So, yeah, this was a phenomenal game, and several off-the-field instances occurred. I guess certainly the championship, Alabama won the AP national title that year. That's an on-the-field instance, and they also went on to win the SEC title that season. But the big off-the-field one is this back-and-forth series gets knotted up at 14 apiece. So that's a very crucial element in terms of the Iron Bowl, because this is a very streaky series, and as time progresses and as we'll get to on more of these Crimson Classics, things get really back and forth. And as you mentioned, Brett, Alabama able to reel off a couple in a row and knot things up 14 apiece in the Iron Bowl series.
Absolutely. And Alabama also broke the mold with their kick return game. They hadn't really been very volatile in the kick return game. They only averaged 26 yards per kick return that year. But in this game against Auburn, they had a 107-yard kick return touchdown from Raymond Ogden. Now that is a 1960s name if I've ever heard one. Raymond Ogden with a 107-yard touchdown return for Alabama to take control of that 1964 Iron Bowl, which Alabama won 21-14 over the Auburn Tigers. Let's go on with our next Crimson Classic to 1985, where Alabama was having a pretty good year, tied with LSU in game number 9 before the Iron Bowl, which Alabama won 25-23, went on to the Aloha Bowl that year to beat USC 24-3. But in that 1985 Iron Bowl, of course, it's the famous kick game with Van Tiffin making the 52-yard field goal to beat Auburn in the final seconds. But really, Alabama had control of this game up until the fourth quarter. Alabama was leading at the end of the first quarter 10-0, and then Auburn comes roaring back with 13 points in the fourth quarter. Alabama's only able to put up 9 points in the fourth quarter. They score a touchdown but didn't get the 2-point conversion before Van Tiffin's 52-yard field goal to end it.
Wow, they went for 2-point conversions in the 80s. Quite a...
Yeah, I didn't expect that one, did you? But it's true. Actually, both Alabama and Auburn went for a 2-point conversion in the fourth quarter. Both of them failed, but probably set up the game-winning field goal there for Van Tiffin.
The 80s was a new wave. Well, the first of the Tide family Tiffin kickers, say that 5 times fast, and that was a series long at that point kick, 52 yards at that point. No kick had been longer in the history of the Iron Bowl, and Mike Shula led that offensive unit for the Tide, of course, coming back later. Maybe we prefer to remember him as a player over a coach.
Probably. I think it's safe to say that most Alabama fans want to remember him as a player over a head coach, especially when you're looking back at that 1985 Iron Bowl. Now let's move on to the 1991 Iron Bowl, where Alabama won that Iron Bowl 13-6, took a 32-23-1 series lead over Auburn back at Legion Field in 1991. Again, Alabama winning that game 13-6 over the hated Auburn Tigers. And that was a 1991 team that had Saran Stacy running the show on the ground. He ended that year with 1,000, just short of 1,000 yards, actually. Had some losses in there for 967 total yards, but did have 10 touchdowns on 200 carries back in 1991.
Yeah, this is the second Gene Stallings Iron Bowl, in which it's kind of infamous in Alabama football history, because it would vault the Tide into that blockbuster bowl game victory, which would lead them to a top 10 national ranking, placing them on the correct track as they would beat Auburn again the following season, causing Auburn its first sub-500 season since the Pat Dye era began, which of course then allowed Alabama to win that 1992 national title game, which was Alabama's first national title since Bear Bryant's 1979 team.
Absolutely. Now let's go to the one great Iron Bowl that most of us all remember and will remember for the rest of our lives. On November 27th, 2009, in Jordan-Hare Stadium, where this one is being played on, the four-year anniversary of this game, Alabama beats Auburn 26-21. Greg McElroy to Roy Upchurch, completing one of the most epic comebacks in Alabama football history.
Well, what I remember in this game, obviously, you can talk about how the game started with the Terrell Zachary, a very huge run, and Alabama looked dazed and confused to start the first quarter of that game. They let Auburn score 2 touchdowns, and the score was 14-0, but Trent Roacheson brought them back to reality in the second quarter with a 2-yard scamper to make things 14-7, and then Colin Peake had a 33-yard pass from Greg McElroy, who was extremely efficient, and this was the first step in his 3 games of really cementing himself as a very talented Alabama quarterback. A lot of people kind of just gave him the game manager label before this game and before he hopped down the sidelines and that win against Florida in the SEC championship game. But you take away from this game, Mark Ingram certainly, Trent Richardson, all the names, Julio Jones out there, but Roy Upchurch, a guy who started the season number 1 on Alabama's depth chart, had that pass to seal the game from Greg McElroy on a play action fake that Alabama still runs today using Jahlstin Fowler in that situation. So it was great to see Roy Upchurch, who had a very underrated career with the Alabama Crimson Tide, cap off a 26-21 win in this Iron Bowl.
Different formation, same exact scheme. You're right. I'm glad you mentioned the Terrell Zachary run on the reverse that scored that touchdown. He was actually Auburn's leading rusher on the day. That one carry for 67 yards led Auburn. Ben Tate was number 2 with 18 carries for 45 yards, only 2.5 yards per carry. Auburn was held to less than 100 rushing yards outside of that one reverse. Terrell Zachary ran for 67. Auburn ran for 151 on that day. This was a very, It was a very Gene Chizik team because they committed 8 penalties for 68 yards compared to Alabama only committing 4 for 26. And then Chris Todd just wasn't quite the Auburn quarterback that they needed that year. 15 for 25, 181 yards, 2 touchdowns, 1 interception. But I think we're all going to remember Trent Richardson and Mark Ingram starting to slowly take this game over. Really, it was Trent Richardson, and not with their ability to run the ball for big chunks of yards, but really just to move the chains in key situations. The numbers are actually underwhelming for both of them. Trent Richardson, 15 carries for 51 yards, and especially for Mark Ingram in his Heisman season, 16 carries for 30 yards, but 17 first downs. That's where Alabama got Auburn in this one. It wasn't that they were able to really run the ball at will against Auburn, but they were able to just move the chains on the ground when it was a third and short situation. Alabama did just that.
Well, you look at the drive chart, the seal play to Roy Upchurch, and you see Trent Richardson's name a lot, as yep. you just mentioned. And a lot of these runs are only 4 or 3 yard runs, but they kept things going and they set up the pass, especially passes to Julio Jones, who caught 4 balls on this series. And Trent Richardson had a 17 yard reception as well. And Trent Richardson also compiled over 30 yards rushing, and he only had 50 on the day, so that really tells you how impactful this drive was. And it started at the Alabama 20, and they were able to get all the way down the field and finish things off on a drive that lasted 7 minutes. So, and then of course Chris Todd had a chance to do it, and he made a couple of plays, but really wasn't able to put Auburn in a position to come back and win this game. And Rolando McClain and Marcel Darius being on that defensive front, that to me really explains the lack of rushing yards as you were mentioning, and obviously Mark Barron being able to come up and help with the run. This was a phenomenal game and obviously led on to greater things in the long run, as did the 1991 game.
Let's get to our Alabama in the awards part of our Crimson Tide Game Day podcast here, where as we get towards the end of the year, not only do things become a little bit more clear in the BCS polls and the rush for BCS bowls and all that, we also get to learn a little bit about our postseason awards and figure out who is in the running to win what. And just as a general rule, if the award can be given to a linebacker, C.J. Mosley is a semifinalist or even a finalist in some situations. He is a finalist for both the Lombardi Award given to the best lineman or linebacker and for the Nagurski Award given to the best defensive player by a Association of Football Writers. He's also a semifinalist for the Bednarik Award given to the best defensive player and a semifinalist for the Butkus Award given to the best linebacker. And I'll never forget when Rolando McClain won the Butkus Award back in 2009. He remembers Dick Butkus making the trip to Tuscaloosa on campus to give him the Dick Butkus Award, and he says, "You think you're a pretty good linebacker," and then Dick Butkus shows up on campus. I think the same thing will probably end up happening to C.J. Mosley. He thinks he's a pretty good linebacker, and then Dick Butkus shows up on campus to give him the Butkus Award. That, again, that's assuming Dick Butkus will in fact award the Butkus Trophy to C.J. Mosley. Just how many of these awards can C.J. win? I think he can win pretty much all of them. He's in there.
Oh, definitely. I don't think he'll win all of them just because the award systems don't really work like that, but I think he's certainly qualified to win them all. Obviously, you've got a lot of talented defensive players. We talked already about one of them in the show, Anthony Barr, and then you look to Wisconsin's Chris Borland. We talked about Michael Sam in the show. Certainly a lot of options there, but I think C.J. Mosley has to be in the top three in all four of these awards that you just mentioned, and the reasons being he leads the team in tackles with 88 total tackles, and by the way, that's 37 more than the second most leading tackler on the team, which is Landon Collins. And you also look at his impact on the passing game. He has 5 pass breakups and 8 quarterback hurries. He's also forced a fumble, and he has 9 tackles for loss. So whatever you need C.J. Mosley to do, he can do. And you compared him to Rolando McClain. I'll even go a step further. Rolando McClain, before C.J. Mosley, was one of my favorite Alabama linebackers, but I think C.J. Mosley has the leadership ability that Rolando McClain lacked and the ability to make reads pre-play that, while Rolando McClain made, he didn't really ever make them at the next level, which kind of explained his NFL struggles with the Oakland Raiders.
Yeah.
Obviously, off-field issues, had problems with that as well, but Mosley certainly should be in the top three in all of these awards, and I think he will at least win 2 of them.
I'm sure he will, but there is actually a precedent for having a serious sweep of awards like that, and it's none other than Manti Te'o last year. Manti Te'o, not only did he win the Bednarik, the Nagurski, the Butkus, and the Lombardi, he also won the Lott, the Maxwell, ooh, and the Walter Camp.
Wow.
He cleaned up. He won basically everything but the Heisman, which obviously went to Johnny Manziel. But for those of you that think it's impossible for C.J. Mosley to win everything, including the national championship, assuming that does come Alabama's way, it's not entirely possible. These are only four awards he's nominated for. Manti Te'o won seven in 1 year that was obviously plagued by the fake girlfriend scandal later on in the season. But there is a precedent for C.J. Mosley to really clean house on these awards. And if anybody's going to do it, I think it should be C.J. Mosley.
And Manti could have even won the Thorpe. He had a lot of interceptions, so he's up there in the top of that list. That's very impressive. I knew he had won several of the awards. I didn't know the extent. The Maxwell and the Walter Camp, those are typically offensive awards.
Yeah, so they're basically Heismanettes is how they're generally known. They're basically smaller awards given out to those who are deemed to be the best player in college football. Manti Te'o won those awards as well. Let's go to the trenches, where Cyrus Quanjo is a semifinalist for the Outland Trophy. And it's funny how Alabama fans have kind of put the bar so high for Cyrus Quanjo. There was some talk around him being the best offensive lineman in the nation, bar none. He's kind of fell short of that expectation, but it again shows just how high the preseason bar was for him, because he's fell short of Tuscaloosan expectations, but he's still a semifinalist to be the best offensive lineman in the nation.
Yeah, I think the Tuscaloosa expectations also had a lot to do with him playing alongside his brother, Ari. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the chemistry and the ability to gel was there as much as Alabama fans hoped for and Alabama fans would imagine with having two brothers of the same stature and same prominence and same talent level playing alongside each other. But I look at one guy who could possibly be more likely to win it over Cyrus Quanjo. Obviously, like C.J. Mosley, I wouldn't at all be surprised if he wins this award. But I look at Florida State center Brian Stork as kind of the nemesis, so to speak, for this award. He's a 6'4", 300-pound senior, and kind of like Barrett Jones, he's played at one point in his career every position on the offensive line. And the Seminoles' offense averages over 50 points a game, 52 points per game, a little bit more than Alabama's there if you're looking at just numbers. And he's a fifth-year player with 36 career starts. And as I mentioned, Barrett Jones-esque, just arguably with more NFL potential.
Absolutely. And if we're looking at players that can take the award away from Cyrus Quanjo, I'm looking at Cyril Richardson out of Baylor. Of course, they didn't play too well last weekend against Oklahoma State, but it is a very good opportunity for Cyril Richardson, who goes up against some actually surprisingly talented Big 12 defensive ends. We make fun of the Big 12 and its lack of strength, but there actually is some talent on the defensive line and in the Big 12, and I think that Cyril Richardson does have a chance to take this thing away from Cyrus Quanjo. Before we get to the Heisman, let's look at that Thorpe Award you mentioned earlier. Landon Collins was named a semifinalist for that award. I think we generally assumed that it was going to go to HaHa Clinton Dix at the beginning of the year, but the whole NCAA investigation and the two games off probably hurt his case for a pretty good bit. Not even named a semifinalist. Landon Collins, however, named a semifinalist, and I don't think his play on special teams is going to help him win this award, unfortunately. I don't know that he's got the interceptions and the pass breakups to win this award, which generally goes to cornerbacks since they're being thrown at more than safeties. But for a sophomore that's as young as Landon Collins is, it's very difficult to keep him out of the finalists for this list when they do cut the Thorpe Award finalists down from the 8 or 10 range it is now to the 4 or 5 that will eventually be finalists for the Thorpe Award.
Yeah, and the Thorpe also stayed in the SEC since 2009. And Landon, as you mentioned, a current candidate, HaHa, on the preseason award watch list for this one. But Vinny might have had a stronger shot thanks to those two defensive pick six that he had versus A&M and versus Virginia Tech. So I think the overall talent in the Alabama secondary might actually work against Landon Collins in this situation in terms of him vying for an individual accolade. I'm sure he's not all that concerned. As you mentioned, a sophomore, so he'll have plenty of opportunities to come back and vie for these awards. But the SEC lost a lot of defensive backs in the draft, including last year's winner Jonathan Banks, and other than and Landon Collins, who, like Cyrus Kwanjo and like C.J. Mosley, will more than likely finish in the top three as a finalist, as you just mentioned in this award. But my main person for this one is Jimmy Ward from Northern Illinois. The unit just has improved so much. The defensive secondary for the Huskies under his senior leadership, NFL size and speed, conference where there's really not a lot of lockdown defensive backs. Obviously, the MAC doesn't have the best offense either, so you could make that as a counter-argument to him vying for this award. But he has 74 tackles, 11 pass breakups, and 6 picks. So those numbers are a little bit more impressive than Landon Collins, and I really did wish that special teams would impact this, because Landon Collins, certainly everyone in the stadium I know, just had gotten used to identifying whoever was making a special teams tackle by yelling out, "Landon!" So he's a very talented player.
If there were a special teams player award, it would go to Landon basically every year until he finally did leave the University of Alabama. Now, of course, the award we all care about, the Heisman Trophy. We had so many fantastic candidates for this award, and it seems like especially last weekend, if not in the few weekends before, they've all just kind of dropped like flies out of it. The whole Jameis Winston allegations with the Tallahassee Police Department, that's muddled his Heisman campaign a little bit. Johnny Manziel's offseason behavior still hurting his campaign, although if you look at the numbers, he's actually having a better season this year than he is last year. Bryce Petty's egg against Oklahoma State last weekend, that took him out. Marcus Mariota not playing very good, and they're both of their losses to both Arizona and Stanford actually being outshined by the other quarterback in both of those games. His Heisman candidacy has been severely hurt. Jordan Lynch, Derek Carr, Teddy Bridgewater among the list of folks that just don't play the right competition to be really considered as Heisman Trophy candidates. But who are we leaving out? That one little guy we call A.J. McCarron, the quarterback here in Tuscaloosa, and the more he plays, the more Stuart Mandel at Sports Illustrated put it best. It's almost about time to break the in case of emergency A.J. McCarron glass if you're a Heisman voter. It seems like he's always been just outside of serious contention for the Heisman Trophy, and now it looks like it's finally coming his way, since it seems like everybody else is dropping like flies week after week.
Well, you said it before the show, and I echo your sentiments of I'm not really sure if anyone wants to win this award, and that's kind of how it's looking. And I think that it's a little sad if you're A.J. McCarron that you're kind of the emergency guy, but at the same time you're not complaining, because right now you are in the lead in this race. And I don't think I would have ever said this at the beginning of the season, but my favorite for winning the Heisman is A.J. McCarron right now. Bryce Petty played very poorly versus Oklahoma State. You look at Johnny Manziel and his career struggles versus LSU, and like I said on the Friday student section last week about his lack of a Heisman moment, he really hasn't had one. So I think for Jameis Winston to vault ahead of A.J. McCarron, he's going to need a Heisman moment, and he doesn't really have the opportunity to have one. He plays the Florida Gators, which, as we know, just lost to an FCS school and certainly aren't the marquee defensive team under Will Muschamp that they were before all these injuries stacked up. But I look at A.J. McCarron and I say, hey, he's got a real opportunity here, and you kind of hinted at it as well, the Iron Bowl and the SEC Championship. Obviously, the voting comes in for the Heisman before the national title game, so, you know, if it was to come after the national title game, I would say A.J. would have a much better chance, because his odds of winning the national title are much higher than any other quarterback. But if he's able to win the toughest conference in major college football and beat a rival that in this game, and everyone is saying in the history of this game, this upcoming Iron Bowl being the most important Iron Bowl in the history of the game, that's obviously a bold statement, but at the same time, that's kind of tough to argue with right now. So if AJ is able to take care of business and not turn the ball over, which is something I don't think I would have said once again at the beginning of the season as a requirement for a Heisman candidate, simply not turn the ball over, but AJ has done a phenomenal job, and like I said, if he wins these two games, then I think that he wins the Heisman.
Like you mentioned, AJ has a huge spot to win this Heisman Trophy. He's got Auburn on national television, on CBS. Missouri in the SEC Championship game, assuming they get there, assuming they beat Texas A&M today, on national television at a neutral site with one of the best defensive lines in the country. I think most Heisman voters recognize that. And what's really going to decide this Heisman candidacy, I think, is the West. The voters out of the West, it seems like every year there's been some candidate to come out of the West to steal votes away from a Southeastern Conference or an ACC or a Big 12 guy. Last year it was Johnny Manziel. Manziel and Colin Klein, both coming out of the Midwest region, out of formerly Big 12 territory, now obviously A&M and the SEC. Then you've seen Toby Gerhardt out of Stanford, and even DeAnthony Thomas in the preseason out of Oregon, guys that have come in taking away a lot of Western votes from players on the eastern side of the country because there was a Western candidate. This year, there isn't really that guy. Marcus Mariota's thrown himself out of the race. Tyler Gaffney doesn't have the preseason hype around him to win this award. It really depends on if those Western voters see enough of A.J. McCarron in the Auburn game and the SEC championship game to take this award by the throat and take it away and win it. Does A.J. McCarron have the game he needs to have against those two teams to win it? I guess we have to wait and see. But if A.J. does, let's say he throws for 250 yards and two touchdowns minimum against both of those teams, has a completion percentage of 70% or higher in both of those games, one on the road, one on a neutral site, both against top 10 teams when they're undefeated, they've got the pressure on the world of their shoulders, I think it's tough to take the award away from him.
I definitely think it's tough to take it away from him. And you could also use those two games that kind of amplify what he's done already going throughout the course of the season. And you talk about the second level of guys. I think, honestly, I just mentioned the guys that have played themselves out of this, but the second level of guys aren't on premier enough teams in order to win the Heisman. And that's what the award has become. It's become the best player on the best teams, or at least a team that can compete for the national title. And you look at that second level, and it's the Jordan Lynches and the Derek Carrs. Derek Carr threw for 7 touchdowns versus New Mexico State. And then you have Andre Williams, Kadeem Carey, who just came on late. And then, of course, you have a running back who's a very talented guy out there out of Washington in the form of Bishop Sankey, who's really not receiving too much accolade. So, yeah, you're exactly right. AJ doesn't need to do too much. He just needs to keep doing what he's doing.
Now let's go to, before we get to our By the Numbers part here on a Crimson Tide Game Day podcast, we're going to get to our Smart Football segment. Every week we break out the grease board, the X's and O's, and get into the finer things of the opposing team. And this time it's Auburn. And of course, everything has revolved around the Auburn run game that's gotten all the attention in the world through the past 3 or 4 weeks, totally looking ahead of some of the competition like Chattanooga, Mississippi State, getting to Auburn's run game, which is one of the more versatile run games in the Southeastern Conference and really in the nation. I think a lot of the lesser educated fans, trying to say that as nicely as possible, I don't want to offend anybody.
No offense.
But some of the lesser educated fans of the Alabama Crimson Tide, or really the SEC as a whole, have looked at the Arkansas game. Alabama played and shut out Arkansas and said, well, Arkansas does nothing but run the ball. Auburn ain't going to be able to run the ball either. I don't think that's really fair, because Auburn's run game is so different and so much more versatile than Arkansas's run game that they can run the ball really on anybody if they do it right.
Yeah, Arkansas, really, to summarize their run game, is man assignments and having a dominant offensive line, and they really don't have that right now, which is why that's not working. But you look at the Auburn Tigers, and you hit on it very well, Brett. Motion, options, different sets. They like to run zone plays out of the shotgun, but they'll really run a zone run out of any sort of formation. And you're going to see 4 guys touching the ball. You're going to see a lot of variety going on here in terms of personnel and scheme. So it's not just simply, hey, what type of look can we get? But we're also going to throw a couple of different guys in there, those guys being Trey Mason, Cameron Artis Payne, and Corey Grant. And obviously, we talked about the passing game and some of the reasons why it wasn't as dominant as most SEC passing attacks are, and it's because of Nick Marshall's run game. He's very effective on the ground. He has done everything that they've asked for him to do in terms of running the football. And you look at Trey Mason, he's got 1,150 yards rushing. Artis Payne has close to 600. Corey Grant has close to 600 as well. So you have 3 running backs who have all impacted the game in terms of averaging over 6 yards a carry and getting close to 600 yards, and in Trey Mason's form, close to 1,200 yards. So, and then you have Nick Marshall, who has 800 yards rushing. It's a very talented, very diverse run game, and if it's able to work at its peak, it is equivalent, if not better, than Oregon, just because they're able to do things versus a higher caliber team. So it's an interesting aspect to see how well are they going to be able to lean on this, or are they going to do, as I've kind of suggested earlier on in the program, and require more balance?
I think the most difficult thing about Auburn's run game is they either force your first step, if you're a linebacker or a defensive end or even a safety coming up as the eighth man in the box, They force your first step to either be, one, just flat out wrong in the wrong direction, or delayed. And that if you delay the first step of an instinctual linebacker like a C.J. Mosley or a true run stopper like a Trey DePriest, you bought yourself 2 yards of no contact just like that. And I mean 2 yards past the line of scrimmage. And a lot of that comes from what we call a cross-buck motion kind of scheme Auburn uses. They do a lot of pre-snap motion in their run games. For example, they'll have 2 wide receivers on the strong side of a shotgun formation with an up back. Let's say it's on the right side. So they've got a running back to the left of Nick Marshall, an up back to his right, and then 2 wide receivers out to his right as well. They'll bring the slot wide receiver in motion towards the backfield to make it look like there's a reverse coming across Nick Marshall's body towards the left side of the formation, when really, at the snap of the ball, the running back on the left side is going to loop behind Nick Marshall, go towards the right side of the formation where the motioning wide receiver used to be, and then Nick Marshall will pull the handoff from the wide receiver, and actually you've got a speed option going the other way. So instead of having a wide receiver in motion on what we call a jet sweep going towards the weak side of the formation, you've actually got a speed option going towards the strong side of the formation with an up back as an extra blocker on the edge where that wide receiver used to be on the slot. So it really, plays can turn on a dime just like that. And if you're forcing C.J. Mosley, not necessarily to be wrong in their first step, right, because late. Yeah, because for the most part, so disciplined this Alabama defense is, they aren't going to make the wrong move more times. They are going to be late on occasion, however, and when you're forcing Alabama to be so cerebral and really think everything through, they're not able to play fast like Nick Saban wants them to play.
Yeah, and what counteracts that lateness is something that Auburn's also good at preventing, and that's gang tackles. If you're going to be late, if you're going to be late on a play as an individual, you're going to need some help in order to bring down the ball carrier. And Auburn really doesn't record a lot of assisted tackles in terms of opponents that they face. It's a lot of solo numbers in terms of those tackles. So if Auburn's able to do all this and really keep the layering going, and that's kind of the key also, as you were mentioning, a lot of these plays are very layered. So you see one look and then you see it again and it's a similar look, but it's really just a completely different play, attacking a different area of the field, pulling a guard, doing things of that nature, then it's going to be very hard for the Alabama defense to stop. But I think the most important thing about it all is Alabama just needs to, bottom line, win individual matchups and push the trenches backwards and force Auburn to pass. If Alabama can force Auburn to pass, then things will head in a direction that Nick Saban would prefer.
Winning solo matchups especially applies to the solo tackles, like you mentioned earlier. If you've got Cameron Artis Payne out on the edge, his feet move at the speed of Lamborghinis or Ferraris. Those guys, they're impossible to catch up with in space. If he can get just one good cut on a linebacker in space, you're taking a 3-yard gain on the sidelines to a 20-yard busted run for a first down. That's something that Auburn does very well, and it's something that very dangerous, because if this becomes a close game and Alabama needs to keep the ball away from Auburn's offense with a 6, 7, 8 minute drive towards the end of the game, if Auburn continues to stay on the field with big running plays for first downs, that could easily take the game away from Alabama if they let it. Let's go to the defensive side, where we mentioned Auburn's defensive line earlier in our four down segment when we went four downs with the Auburn Tigers. It's all part of the 4-2-5 defense that Ellis Johnson has been known for decades. He tried at South Carolina, and it worked very well there. South Carolina actually also the origin of the 3-3-5 defense. Not very many people know that, but the zone blitz and the 3-3-5 have roots back to South Carolina. And Ellis Johnson brought the 4-2-5 to Columbia, South Carolina as well. The 4-2-5 defense, to break it down and oversimplify, and I'll let you go into a more detailed, Andrew, to oversimplify the 4-2-5, the theory for the 4-2-5 is they're hoping that the 4 defensive linemen will be able to stuff anything on the inside, and then on the outside is where you have your 2 linebackers either lined up wide to stop the wide run, or you've got an extra defensive back on there. The speed of the defensive back will be able to find a way to at least hold up a runner to get a gang tackle on the outside. And then obviously it's a beneficial route to go with for the passing game if you're going base out of the 4-2-5, because you've always got 5 defensive backs on the field.
And defensive ends in this scheme aren't just responsible for getting after the passer with those 2 linebackers. They're really responsible for controlling the edge. coverage more so, if you will. The key, I guess, the trick to the 4-2-5 is the terminology used in the secondary. And I believe we talked about it on Friday student section before, but the star hybrid is kind of the player, I guess the Landon Collins player before the Vinny Sunseri injury is the best way for me to explain it to Alabama fans. When Alabama had Sunseri and Clinton Dix in the backfield, kind of a player who roves around the field and controls whatever position is threatening the defense most, whether that be a tight end or a running back, whatever that may be.
Jarek Williams, another example of
that. Right, Jarek Williams currently. And then you have the boundary and the field cornerbacks, and those are kind of as they sound. One of them is really responsible for the sidelines or whatever the narrow part of the field is, and then the field cornerback is responsible for the wide part, and then you have those same two terms, the boundary and field, that apply to the safety. And the trick to this is it's not going to be the same set on every snap, because Ellis Johnson likes to insert two stars in the game. He'll add those extra hybrid linebackers, DBs, giving the opposing quarterback more to think about, and that's really the purpose of that, is pre-snap reads. Sometimes on running downs there might also be three linebackers or even an extra defensive lineman. You'll see the star cover the slot receiver, the tight end, or running back, and they also blitz from a lot of different levels. And as the hybrid can come from the secondary or put his hands down the front line, it's just a lot of versatility. And Auburn even runs some 3-4 from time to time, so you'll see them line up in a traditional scheme that Alabama has also run.
Before we get to our position breakdowns with other members of the 90.7 The Capstone sports staff, as we continue on with our Crimson Tide Game Day podcast, we're going to get into our By the Numbers segment. And we mentioned earlier in our four downs where the Nick Marshall being able to pass thing has been a very hot topic surrounding this game for several weeks now. So we looked at the numbers. Can Nick Marshall pass? The numbers are actually going to lead you both ways. Nick Marshall has thrown for over 200 yards in a game four times this year against Mississippi State, Texas A&M, Georgia, and LSU. That's not a bad note for the resume. Other quarterbacks that have thrown for 200 yards exactly four times this year include Ohio State's Braxton Miller and none other than Alabama's A.J. McCarron. Thrown for 200 yards in a game four times this year, no more, no less, the same amount of times as Nick Marshall. And why would they throw it anyway? Of their recent opponents, Florida Atlantic ranks sixth in the nation in pass defense, with LSU at 18 and Tennessee at 24.
Wow, that's very impressive. And to see kind of the similarities and the parallel between Alabama and Auburn, I would not have guessed that A.J. McCarron had a similar numbers to Nick Marshall in terms of just yards per game and averages that way, but I can kind of see it based off the schedule. And Braxton Miller, that's very shocking, because I remember him just rolling through some Big Ten opponents during the midseason. Obviously, he was injured for a little bit, but at the same time, and for Nick Marshall to have those numbers against LSU, as we talked about earlier on the show, Johnny Manziel having only a 22 QBR in his two career games versus LSU compared to an 88 QBR versus every other opponent, that's a stout fact in favor of Nick Marshall.
Now, see, here's where I said the numbers get ready to lead you both ways. Obviously, that number leads you to believe that Nick Marshall is going to be able to pass very well. Here's the number that's going to lead you to believe that Auburn's going to struggle throwing the ball. I just mentioned that Nick Marshall has thrown for over 200 yards in four games this year. He's also thrown for less than 100 yards four times this season. A.J. McCarron has never done that in a start. Every game he started, he's thrown for at least 100 yards. The last time he threw for less than 100 yards in a game is when he went 6-for-6 for 51 yards in a backup role when he took Greg McElroy out of the 2010 Capital One Bowl, in which Alabama obliterated Michigan State. But A.J. McCarron, to kind of contrast the previous number, has thrown for at least 100 yards in all of his starts now in his third year as Alabama starting quarterback. Nick Marshall has failed to do that four times in 11 starts.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the reason for this being the yards per pass. I think A.J. McCarron is able to get in a better groove and able to throw things underneath and exploit different areas of the passing game, while Nick Marshall, as we talked about earlier on the show, really relies on Sammy Coates. And they also don't have a tight end like they're used to, and Alabama fans will be glad to not see Philip Lutzenkirchen on the field, as he certainly impacted Alabama very prominently in that 2010 game. But yeah, I think Nick Marshall can pass, as I said. I'm reluctant to give him the openness that I would give to an A.J. McCarron, a Zach Mettenberger, guys of that nature that have been there and done that, because it really just hasn't had any situation for Nick Marshall where he's been required to throw the football.
Auburn's passing attack aside, I think we can all agree on one part of Auburn's offense that needs improvement. Touchdowns in the red zone. Auburn is sixth in the SEC as less than 69% of their red zone appearances and in touchdowns. Let's put it another way. Over 31% of their red zone appearances and in three or less points. Here's a list of teams across the nation that are better than Auburn in this category. That list includes Wyoming, New Mexico, Louisiana Lafayette, Temple, and Buffalo. All of those teams score a higher percentage of red zone touchdowns than Auburn does.
Yeah, and that's speaking to the fact that they're really having to run in order to get to that point in the field, and then when they get down there, the defenses have realized that they're very one-dimensional. It's hard to pass in the red zone, so that's why you really use the pass to set yourself up to get in that situation, and then once you get down there underneath the 20, you're able to run and be a lot more efficient because you haven't been doing it as much over the course of a drive, and that's not going to fly against Alabama. That's not going to go well. Alabama is a very good red zone defense, and they're going to be able to restrict running lanes. So Auburn, as I said, they're going to need to show balance before they get into that situation in order to really fully execute and improve those numbers.
If you follow Carson Tinker, former Alabama long snapper, on Twitter, you've heard him say a time or two that special teams wins football games. And we're going to go into the special teams numbers here in this matchup a little bit. And ladies and gentlemen, Auburn's Chris Davis Jr. is a problem. Chris Davis Jr. is second in the nation, averaging 22.5 yards per punt return, and he's trending upwards. In the month of November alone, Davis has averaged 36.25 yards per punt return. He's returned four punts for 145 yards and a touchdown. This is actually one of the more interesting matchups in this entire game, as Cody Mandel is averaging 47.3 yards per punt, a number that would rank third in the nation if he had enough punts to qualify. He's actually so good. His team is actually so good, he's actually costing him a chance at some postseason awards. Furthermore, as a special teams unit, Alabama is averaging only 5 yards per opposing punt return. So they're holding opponents to 5 yards per punt return. Chris Davis obviously has something to say about that.
Yeah, and Christian Jones is salivating because he is excited to face Chris Davis. Obviously, when you look at Chris Davis, obviously it's not even only the lack of yards on these punts. It's also he's having some hang time issues as well. And you mentioned the season Cody Mandel is having. I'm not sure if I've seen more coffin corner punts in my life than I've seen this season from Cody Mandel. The guy can just drop it on a dime on the field and let it stay there. He has mastered the spin, the backspin needed to really pin opponents inside a very tight territory.
You just mentioned Christian Jones. With his 75-yard punt return for a touchdown against Chattanooga last weekend, Christian Jones got his third punt return of the year. Now get this, Jones by himself has as many punt return touchdowns as the rest of the SEC combined. Auburn has one, Tennessee has one, and Ole Miss has one. So Christian Jones has three. The other 13 football teams in the SEC have three as well.
And people that want to knock on the fact that this third one came against Chattanooga, don't forget where the first two came from, against one of the nation's historically most premier special teams coaches that college football has seen in terms of Frank Beamer. I mean, they call it Beamer ball for a reason. He's certainly able to coach up a unit and able to shut down the special teams, but I don't know. Like I just said previously, Alabama's have a lot of talented special teams guys. Going back to Marquise Mays and going back to Javier Arenas, those are two very elite guys that were able to, for a time being, Javier Arenas especially, make an impact in the NFL on that level. So Christian Jones is separating himself and establishing himself as better than these two guys, and I don't think anybody would have seen this coming.
And now what we're all really here for, let's break down the struggle that will be Auburn's run offense versus Alabama's run defense. Rushing yards per game, Auburn's offense is third in the nation. Alabama's defense is fourth in the nation. Yards per carry, Auburn's offense is fourth in the nation. Alabama's defense is seventh in the nation. First downs, when running the ball, Auburn's offense is sixth in the nation. Alabama's defense is second in the nation. Nobody gets first downs running the ball against Alabama. And finally, runs of 10 yards or more. Auburn's offense, fourth in the nation. Alabama's defense, second in the nation. We've said it several times throughout the year, but I think this is the best example. Something has to give.
Yeah, something definitely does. And going back to the theme that you've seen throughout the course of this podcast, I think that first down stat is the most important one, because how are they going to set themselves up to convert these first downs? They really, obviously, as you just showed with these statistics, can't just rely on getting themselves in third and short every time and bulldozing the Alabama defense. That doesn't work against Alabama and has not worked against Alabama dating back to 2008. So you look at this matchup and you look at the statistics that you just read, and I feel like Alabama's defense is going to kind of trend as they have in these major games, and that's really, you'll see a significant difference starting at about the 5-minute mark in the third quarter. But other than that, I think Auburn's going to be able to do things that they've done all season so long, as I've harped on, keep that balance, get Nick Marshall maybe a couple of throws on first down in order to mix things up, because that's going to really be key for Auburn coming to the fourth quarter.
That's going to be it for this section of the Crimson Tide Game Day podcast on the Auburn Tigers. I want to thank my co-host, Andrew Wallace, for joining me. I'm going to stick around. Of course, I'm Brett Hudson. We're going to have several members of the 90.7 The Capstone sports staff to help us break down the 2013 Iron Bowl position by position as this Crimson Tide Game Day podcast for the Auburn Tigers continues on here on 90.7 The Capstone.